Welcome to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamic. With Balsamic mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcast the easy way at simplecast.fm. This podcast features Jared Spool, co-founder of Center Center, a design school, and founder of User Interface Engineering, and his keynote, Design is a Team Sport, from August 11th, 2017.
Okay. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Jared Spool.
Thank you. Putting on a conference like this is a lot of work, so let's make some noise if we've enjoyed the work that Russ and Shay and Brad have done. Okay, so yesterday Scott Birkin asked the question, what is good design? So let's talk about what is good design. And let's do that by starting with this. This is not something that Tyler Thompson designed. This is a boarding pass that Tyler Thompson, a designer, received at JFK one day as he was on his way. And he looked at this and had a very sort of designer reaction to it. In fact, the reaction that he had was so visceral that he decided to write a little story of what it must be like to be this boarding pass. And his story goes like this. Hello there. Thanks for flying Delta. I'm sure you are no doubt trying to figure out what the fuck to do with this piece of paper you have in your hand right now. You're confused, lost, and just want to get on your flight. It's cool. We don't really care. And we sure as hell don't want to make this process easy and enjoyable for you. Instead, we hired a small blind parakeet to lay out your boarding pass, you know, just to keep you guessing. Have fun. Tyler didn't stop there. Tyler decided that he was going to take this challenge into his own hands and was going to reimagine what the Delta boarding pass could be like. And this is it. And it's awesome. It's beautiful. It's a wonder of good layout, good information architecture, good visual priority. Everything about this pass is fantastic. He's not the only one who's run into this problem. There's another designer named Dustin Curtis around the same time encountered the American website and had the same sort of visceral reaction. He too decided to take to the airwaves and created a letter that he wrote, a public letter that he wrote to the CEO of American Airlines, for which he said, if I was running a company with this, the distinction and history of American Airlines, I would be embarrassed, no, ashamed, to have a website with a customer experience as terrible as the one you have now. And he too chose to redesign the website and came up with something that's quite delightful, quite beautiful, and really set a sort of thoughtfulness going forward in terms of design. Now, for the last 2 days, we've been using this word design quite a bit without really ever defining it. And the definition that I have found that I like the most is that design is the rendering of intent. And both Tyler and Dustin had the intent to do better. They wanted to create better design. They wanted to create, as Scott put it, good design. And that's what they did. But in Dustin's case, the story doesn't end there. Because it turned out after he had posted his new design and his screed on how awful the old design was, a member of the American Airlines design team wrote him an email. And in that email, that person described what the constraints were, what the issues were, and why Dustin's reimagined website could never, ever happen at American Airlines. Dustin thought the letter was really thoughtful, really good. So he took off the person's name and posted it. But there weren't that many people in the American Airlines design department. It was pretty easy to figure out who it was, and they fired him. Design is the rendering of intent. What was Dustin's intention? Was it to get someone fired? Because that was the outcome he got. By designing a website that didn't have any realistic approach to the constraints that actually happen in a large company like American Airlines. The problem that Dustin ran into is a different one. He ran into the problem of context. Context is where design happens. Every time we design in a context. We have to understand that context. So let's go back to the boarding pass that Tyler Thompson created. Again, a beautiful piece of design. Tyler designed this. He took this on because he's a designer. That's okay. Everybody thinks they're a designer. But Tyler has some amazing design skill. Let's take this thing apart. First, this is a four-color printing. That's really an important point, because the last one was just black and white. It also has bleed edging. For those of you who did not study print design, that means that the ink goes right up to the edge of the paper. There's only two ways to accomplish that in life. You either have to have a pre-cut page, or you have to have a very expensive printer that knows how to print to edges. Similarly, it also uses 300 DPI, which is what you want for laser printed text. But laser printers are more expensive than other types of printers. And finally, there's no way you can get white text in a black background without white stock. And in order to do this cleanly, you need high resolution, very clean paper, and the ability to print that way. So in order for this boarding pass to come to life, Delta would have to replace the 10,000 boarding pass printers they have deployed in the world, none of which can print this boarding pass today. They're almost all thermal printers. They don't have ink. So that means that they would have to outfit those printers with the ability to do bleed capability, which means unusual paper sizes and some sort of cutting mechanism. And on top of that, they would have to create an entire supply chain to make sure that every one of those printers always had the colors it needed all the time. This is not a small change. This is a huge, expensive change for one of the world's largest airlines. So that begs the question, which of these is really the better design? Which one is more perfect? The one that looks fantastic, or the one that meets the business needs today? So if we're going to talk about good design, let's talk about poor design. What makes poor design poor? How does that happen? Well, if design is the rendering of intent, poor design happens either because we have the right design, but it was rendered poorly, or we have a poor intention that was rendered right. Either of these can cause what we would refer to as poor design. So that means that we have to look at both the intention and how we render in order to succeed. This is a map of Magic Mountain theme park in outside San Diego, Six Flags Magic Mountain. And what's fascinating to me about this map is how it was designed, because it's designed to help people make their way through the park, make sure that they get all the value for the very expensive tickets that it costs to go to Magic Mountain. And the fascinating thing about this theme park, or this map, is that it is designed to move you in the order they want you to go. Basically, you come in from the bottom, and you take a left, and you just move your way through the park. They have this habit that you want to make. First, they want you to go stand in very long lines, and then you ride on a very short ride, and then you get off the ride and you throw up for hopefully a very short moment, and then you get on another ride, and you repeat that process 70 times while you're in the park. And that's the experience that they want you to have. This map is designed to make sure that happens. You basically can check off everything you do in numeric order, because each thing is numbered. And they tell you explicitly what each thing is, so you will not miss one item in the park. Now compare this to the map for Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom. And maybe the first thing you'll notice is hardly anything's labeled. In fact, the rides are not visible at all. Sure, if you understand some of the architecture of Disney, you might recognize Space Mountain or Liberty Square or one of the other elements. But for the most part, they don't tell you what's there. And it's not because they don't have rides. They've got great rides. They've got really wonderful rides. But they don't tell you this because it's not the point. It's not why we're there. That's not what we're trying to do. Instead, they have a very different way of thinking about things. If you go to Walt Disney World's Magic Kingdom with, say, a six-year-old, there's a good chance that at least one of the days you're there, it's going to start with a phenomenon known as the character breakfast. And the character breakfast is an opportunity for you and your six-year-old to get up close and personal to what is essentially a creepy guy in an animal suit. And you and your child and the creepy guy in the animal suit will then collaborate to make what will become the most expensive breakfast you will ever pay for. And you will love it. You will love it because your kid loves it. And even the creepy guy in the animal suit seems to enjoy it. And that's how your day starts. And then you move from there into the park, and you go from adventure to adventure to adventure. And before you know it, the day has come to an end. And you know this because the skies erupt with a fireworks show, what will seem at that moment to be probably the longest fireworks show you have ever sat through. And the thing about this fireworks show is it is completely synchronized with music. And no matter where you are in the park, you can clearly see the fireworks and you can clearly hear the music. They have timed both of them using an algorithm that allows them to actually play the music out of the speakers in different ways, depending on exactly how the how far you are from the fireworks. They control all of that. So the fireworks goes on, and then it comes to its natural end, and you pick up your now exhausted six-year-old, and you put them on your shoulder, and you head back to not your hotel, because Disney does not have hotels. They have resorts. You go back to your resort, you open the door to your room, and you discover that while you were gone, someone had been there and made origami animals out of all your towels.
And if your child had left their Disney characters lying around on the floor because they'd been playing with them before you headed out for the day's activities, someone has picked them all up and put them with the origami animals on the bed and made them all look like they were playing together until someone opened the door, and then they all fall flat like in the movie. Because that's how Disney thinks. Disney thinks like that. We can sort of sum this up and say, okay, Six Flags, they think in terms of activities, right? You have a ride, go on the ride. You have another ride, go on a ride. It's time to eat, go eat. It's time to get on another ride, go on the ride. That's how they think. It's very discreet activities. Whereas Disney thinks completely in terms of experience. Experience includes activities, but it also thinks about what happens in between each activity, what happens before the activities, what happens at the end of the activities. All of the parts of the experience are taken as the whole. It's a design process that thinks about the whole. So if we want to talk about design process, it itself is not a set of discrete activities. A design process is, in fact, an experience, and we have to treat it that way. Now, we have lots of design processes. In our field, we are very good at rendering images of design processes. Almost always, they involve either diamonds or loops. Every design process is either diamonds or loops, and in some cases, it's both diamonds and loops. We have gotten into the jewelry phase of the design world, because we're either doing diamonds or loops. But there are many design processes to choose from. You can use this one, the old double diamond from the Design Management Institute. But this isn't the one that Tyler Thompson and Dustin Curtis were using. The process that Tyler Thompson and Dustin Curtis were using has a different name. I call it, I'm pissed off and I'm going to show you how to do it right. This is another type of design process. It's one that we employ a little too frequently. Now, if we're going to design our design process, we have to start asking some important questions. For example, we might ask, who do we put on the design team? How will we make sure that they contribute in a valuable way? When will they need our support to contribute? How do we introduce the design process to these folks? Who will get the credit for any successes that this process has? And most importantly, who's going to take the blame if the process doesn't produce what it's supposed to? These questions are critical because the design process is no longer just designers. It includes all the people who actually end up working. This idea that we need to bring everybody into our process and make sure that they are all part of it is key. Because we absolutely cannot design things without the people who aren't designers in our organizations. They are just as critical. Yet while we give that lip service, we still have a problem. Back in the 60s, a couple of recent researchers, guys named Rosenthal and Folk, conducted an experiment, not on designers, but on rats. It was a very popular time for conducting experiments on rats, and psychologists did this all the time. But this one had particularly telling outcomes. The research ended up being published in a paper called The Effects of Experimental Bias on the Albino Rat in 1963. And the way the experiment worked was like this. Robert Rosenthal went off to his local rat supply store, and he bought himself a whole bunch of fresh experimental rats, a couple dozen of them, brought them back to his lab, and divided them at random into two cages. In one cage, he labeled them smart rats. In the other cage, he labeled them dull rats. And then he invited in the real subjects of his study, his design students, or his psychology students, his PhD students. And he asked them to grab a rat out of one of the cages and run them through a battery of tests that they had been using all semester long to test rats against. So they were completely familiar with the tests. And what they found was shocking. Turns out that every rat that came out of the smart rat cage outperformed every rat that came out of the dull rat cage by an order of magnitude, substantial difference. Now remember, he'd put them in the cages at random. He actually had no idea which rats were truly smart and which ones were not. The students grabbed a rat out of one of the cages, and that determined the outcome. He actually ran this particular experiment with different students multiple times. Every time got the same results. This experiment has been repeated over and over again. It continues to produce the same results. Something about the experimenters were causing the rats to change their performance. Could be that they were standing too close to the rats in some way, or they were backing away. Could be that they were emitting some sort of pheromones that caused the rats to change their behavior. There was something about that. They were able to change the rats' behavior just by thinking whether they were smart or dull. It turns out this same experiment has been conducted not just on rats, but they went off to conduct it on school children. They told teachers that students who had brown eyes actually were smarter than students who had blue eyes. And sure enough, the students with brown eyes started to outperform the students with blue eyes on standardized tests and in assignments. Had less behavioral issues, became better students overall. They went to the workforce, and they told supervisors that employees with brown eyes behaved better than performed better than employees without. And sure enough, the employees with brown eyes were getting better performance reviews, getting more promotions, getting more pay increases. And this has become known in the field as expectancy bias. If you set up the expectation that someone or something is better than something else, you will believe that to the point where your perception of what they do will change how you report what they do. So what happens when we walk into a conference room and in the conference room we immediately identify that some people are expert designers, and some people are not a designer? How does expectancy bias play into that interaction? If we are asking our collaborators to help us solve complex challenges, who do we pay attention to? Who do we believe is capable of helping us solve that problem? So, our expectations can change the outcomes of a project. And so, we must make sure that we understand that our expectations also change the team's outcomes. And we have to be able to ensure that we are getting the best outcome from our team by making sure our expectations are what they need to be. This is a woman named Dana Chisnow. She, until last October, had a really interesting job at the U.S. Digital Service. She did 2 years at the U.S. Digital Service doing an absolutely amazing project. Now, for those of you who haven't heard of the U.S. Digital Service, this is her in front of her office. This is her boss, a guy named Mikey. And his boss was a guy named Barry. And at the Digital Service, she had a particular project that she was working on. It wasn't a sexy project. It was actually quite bland. Because basically what she was doing for the 2 years that she was there, for most of the 2 years she was there, was she was converting paper documents to online documents. It's just an application process. People fill out a form, and it's currently on paper. They're trying to make it digital. How hard could that be? Turns out that this particular application, which was for citizenship and immigration, they process 6 million of these applications a year. Each application can be between 10 and 1,000 pages. And the people who review them to see if the person applying for immigration benefits gets it, there are 3,000 of them. And each application is reviewed approximately 6 times in 6 different places in the world. The postal budget for moving these documents around the world comes to about $300 million a year. So converting this to an online process where you're looking at PDFs instead of paper is a big deal. And it turns out to be really hard. And it's so hard that the team that was involved took 100 developers. It also had 12 technical leads, 10 business analysts, 6 product managers, 2 product owners, and 1 designer named Dana. And Dana's job was to make sure that this process was the most usable, most efficient designed process ever. She couldn't do it by herself, so her design team had to involve everybody else. Anybody who influences the outcome of a design is part of the design team. Anybody who influences the outcome of a design is a designer. And our design teams are no longer filled with trained designers. Most of the people on our teams are influencers who are not trained in design. So how do we get the outcomes from that? To understand this, we have to understand basically how anybody learns anything. Whenever we take on something new, something we've never done before, something that we know nothing about, we start in a particular stage of understanding called unconscious incompetence. Unconscious incompetence means that we don't know how to do this thing, but it also means that we don't know how to do this thing. We are unconscious about our inability to do this. And almost always, people who are in this stage of unconscious incompetence are completely unaware of how bad they are at this thing. They are bad because they're incompetent. Maybe occasionally they do something good because of chance, but chance almost always works against them. So that means that most of the time they produce something that's crappy, but they don't know it. And the only time they find out is when some close friend or coworker takes them aside and says, "Please stop." And at that moment, they learn the difference between good and bad quality. Up until that point, they had no knowledge of the difference between good and bad quality. As far as they were concerned, everything they were doing was good, even though it turns out they've now learned it wasn't. Now they know. And at that moment, they enter the second stage, which is called conscious incompetence. And at conscious incompetence, you now know the difference between good and bad, and you know that what you do is pretty much bad. And most people give up here. This is why many people stop drawing at the age of 7 or 8. This is why people pick up an instrument and then stop playing it. These are all the reasons why we quit. It's because suddenly we become consciously incompetent. This is a very depressing stage. Unconscious incompetence is a very blissful, happy stage. You're just producing stuff. It goes on the fridge. You're happy. Right? Oh, that's wonderful. That's awesome. Right? But at some point, you become consciously incompetent. It's like, nope, we're done. But some people persist. And as they persist, they start to realize that if they practice, if they follow the recipe, if they do the steps the same way each time, they can actually produce good outcomes. And at that point, they become consciously competent. When we are consciously competent, we can produce the work, but we have to think about every step we make. We have to think about the process. We have to think about where we put our fingers on the instrument. We have to think about how we hold the pen and how we draw the thing. We become very conscious of every movement, every step. We can cook the thing, but we have to follow the recipe. If we don't follow the recipe, if we're missing one ingredient, we cannot make the dish. But we can get good results, and we can get them predictably, as long as we have good process, good procedures. But then there becomes a point where we no longer need those. We actually now can start to work in situations where we're not familiar. And from that point, we can actually produce outcomes without really giving it much thought. And at that point, we have now entered unconscious competence. Unconscious competence is that stage when we can walk into a situation, assess where it's at, and even though none of the things have ever appeared in our life before, we can see how to solve this problem. We just take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, we make it work. My wife and I play this game often on the ride to the house in the evening, because we work in the same building, so we go home together. And we often will play this game where one of us will mention an ingredient for dinner that we're sort of hankering for. And the other one's job is now in some sort of mini Iron Chef competition to come up with a meal based on this ingredient without having a recipe prepared, without necessarily having gone shopping specifically for that thing, just be able to throw it together and come up with something edible. And we've gotten quite good at this. That's unconscious incompetence, being able to just deal with what you have and make a good outcome without having to follow a recipe, without having to have a procedure. So here's the deal with Dana and her 130 design team members, which is that Dana had 130 unconsciously incompetent designers. That's what happened on day one. And her job became not to create screens, but to take those 130 unconsciously incompetent designers and at least get them to conscious competence. That's where she needed them to be. If she could get them that far, this design would turn out awesome. At least much better than anything else the government usually produces. And to do that, she had to think about the transitions between the stages. Turns out when you go from unconscious incompetence to conscious incompetence, it's all about literacy. It's about understanding the difference between good and bad, having the vocabulary to talk about that difference, being able to express why things are good, why things are bad. If you can't do that, you can't do any of this. So you have to be able to do at least that. But to get to the next stage, the transition is different. That's about fluency. That's when you actually understand the building blocks. You know what the pieces are, but now you can start to put them together. You can start to assemble them. And yes, you need a recipe, you need a way to do that, but you now become fluent in the mechanics, in the tools, in the language of the work. And if she needed to, if people were rising to the occasion, she could help them enter the next stage, which is between conscious incompetence, or conscious competence, and unconscious competence. And that transition is mastery. That's when we really get to know our craft. When we talk about mastering our craft, we are talking about that transition from conscious competence to unconscious competence. And it turns out that the way to approach this is very situational. And so the way we like to think about it is using a sports ball metaphor. When the sports ball team runs out onto the tennis court or the basketball field or wherever they go, they don't have a giant plan. They don't have a double diamond process. They don't have lots of Gantt charts that say exactly which player is going to score exactly how many minutes into the game. They don't have any of that. But they do have something. They have a playbook. And the playbook is filled with plays. And they choose the play in the moment based on the situation to decide what they need to do. And so if you're going to move people through these different situations, you need to have plays. And we've actually identified 130 plays for UX professionals to help transition between these stages. These are just a small subset of the 130. The play that Dana picked is a great play. Her play that she picked is called Immersive Exposure. And with Immersive Exposure, basically what you do is you just get every team member to watch people use the design. Watch them use the current design, watch them use the new design. Usability testing is a technique, field research is another. There's lots of ways to do this, but they actually have to see the person use it. They can't read a report. They can't watch a video. They have to go and be there. So she started taking the field officers into the field to actually start watching how they interviewed the applicants who are going through the immigration process. And she started with a small group of designers or developers, and she brought them with her. Took a little while to convince the development managers that when they weren't coding, they were still being productive. Got them into the field and had them watch. And they came back and were so excited about what they'd seen that other developers wanted to go. So she started taking them into the field. And they came back, and that spread to others and others. And she could tell, because she would have these meetings where she would have, during stand-ups, they would have to bring screenshots of the work they were doing, and they'd have to put them on the wall next to the last one they had just put on the wall the day before. And they'd have to explain the differences and why they made them. And that was her stand-up with these teams. And as they were explaining, she noticed that the people who'd been in the field were producing better designs than the ones who hadn't. Now, she hadn't taught them anything about design. She hadn't given them a single brown bag lunch on design. She didn't give them any instruction. All she did was take them into the field and then have them come and explain why they were making their decisions. And the ones who'd been in the field produced better outcomes. And the ones who hadn't been in the field started to notice that the other ones were producing better outcomes. So they decided they wanted to go in the field. At one point, she had a sign-up sheet on her door for the next field visits, and it was filling up so fast that she had to actually get another door. She was able to change the culture of design with one single play: immersive exposure. This is Sid Harrell. Sid Harrell currently is the chief of staff of 18F, another design organization inside the federal government. But she was at Code for America before that. And at Code for America, she was teaching people who worked in cities and states basic usability practices. One of the people she taught was this guy, Jonathan Feldman. And he had never heard of usability before. He was an IT director for the city of Asheville, North Carolina. His thing was about building software. That's what he knew. Never thought about making something usable. And he and his team sat in on a workshop at the Code for America conference that Sid taught. It was a one-day workshop where she basically taught them usability testing by having them make animals out of origami. Turns out that if you print instructions on origami off of the internet and you give them to people who don't normally make origami, it's as good a usability test mechanism as anything, because it's almost impossible to succeed. So she would teach them by having them observe each other how to do these origami animals. And she would teach them incredibly, for lack of a better term, sloppy research methodology. Right? Didn't follow any standard protocols, didn't follow any standard processes, just barely enough, because all she needed them to do was to watch users. They took that one-day course, Feldman and his team. They went back, and they created this, which is called Simplicity. Simplicity. It's an app that runs on a phone that will tell you anything you want to know about what the city of Asheville knows about any address inside the city of Asheville. If you put in your address, it'll tell you where your trash pickup is. It will tell you where your connection to the water system is and the sewer lines. It will tell you what your tax payments are. It will tell you how much crime has been in your neighborhood. Anything they could get off of any public data source is pumped into this thing. And it will tell you all of those things. And the residents love it. And they built it by just conducting really sloppy, really unprofessional usability tests first on people in their own office, and then eventually on the citizens of Asheville, North Carolina. And every time they did, they learned something they didn't know about design, and they fixed it. And so she did this with basically guerrilla usability testing techniques, the very basic elements of that, just watching people and then making changes. It wasn't any more sophisticated than that. This is Bill Scott. Bill Scott is a senior vice president at PayPal. And PayPal was having a problem with the checkout process. So anytime you go to a website that says you want to pay with PayPal, you then invoke the PayPal checkout stream. And that process was running on old mainframe computers, and it was this old architecture, and it took forever to fix, and it was horrible, and it didn't run on phones very well, and it was just this miserable thing. And he convinced the executives at PayPal to do something that was probably the hardest thing you could do. He got a handful of people who were the top developers and designers at PayPal. That wasn't the hard thing. He sequestered them to be on this project for 10 months together, not working on anything else. That wasn't the hard thing. The hard thing was he got a conference room for 10 months. Not only that, it was the CEO's conference room. He took over the conference room that adjoined the CEO's because that was the only one that he could get to do this. And they sat there for 10 months, and he brought in Jeff Gottelf to teach them a two-day workshop on Lean UX. And they practiced Lean UX for 10 months and produced a completely redesigned, redeveloped checkout process, not using any of the old technology stack, that outperformed and eventually out-revenued the existing one by an order of magnitude and became the standard for how everything got designed at PayPal. And he did that with a single play, which was Lean UX techniques. These are not complicated things. We know these things. They are things in our toolbox. But what's different about them is they are involving everyone. They are involving the whole team. And they are helping the team members become consciously competent. And that's what these folks did. They came in with an expectation that everybody they were working with could produce great designs. And they gave them the tools with some simple plays to make that happen. So the school that we're creating is called Center Center. It's in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And we've put together a 2-year curriculum that involves 30 courses. And one of the interesting things was, is as I was putting this presentation together, I went back and looked at the curriculum we had created and realized that more than half of the courses involved team skills, team competencies, working with teams. We cannot produce designers anymore that don't know how to work in teams. That is the most important thing we can do. So we need to embrace the idea that everyone is a designer, because they are. We need to help every team member become a better one. So that's what I came to talk to you about. This idea that everybody we work with is a capable designer. They just may not know it yet. And the processes we use have to be designed to make them use their fullest potential as capable designers. And we are in charge of designing those processes. We have to be very, very careful about our own expectations and make sure we're not devaluing talent that's available to us because we believe they aren't capable. We have to understand that the skills necessary to work with a team, what we call facilitated leadership at the school, is the primary skill that designers really bring to the table. It's not drawing. It's not knowing how to what the difference is between a checkbox and a radio button. It's being able to take a team and move them through a process and help them bring the true value. And finally, we have to make conscious competency the goal for every member of that team. If by some reason you found this to be the least bit interesting, I've got a lot more stuff about this on our website at uie.com. If we are not connected on LinkedIn, please connect on LinkedIn with me. It's a good way for us to talk and chat. So that's a good thing. And you can follow me on the Twitters where I tweet about design, design strategy, design education, and the amazing customer service habits of the airline industry. Russ mentioned that the school, so this is a two-year program to make industry-ready UX designers, and it's in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and our first cohort is 10 months in. We are looking to start our second cohort. We have some great applicants, but we are always looking for more. As soon as we're done with the second one, we're going to start the third one. So our goal is to keep starting new cohorts of that. So if you know someone, our school is aimed at career shifters. So these are people who are in a career that they're not thrilled with right now and want to learn something new. There's plenty of room for UX designers right now in the world. So anyone who you know who might be at a point where they want to think about changing their career, this might be the program for them. Send them our way. And we're also looking for projects to give the students because they spend 66% of their time working on real production products and services. So if you have a project that might be a good one, something that would take about your people about 1,000 hours will take our students about 2,500 hours. So that's if you think about something that is a 1,000-hour project that you'd like to see some forward movement on that you're not getting to, it might be perfect for our students. So let me know about that. And finally, the plays that I mentioned are part of a workshop that we've put together called Creating a UX Strategy Playbook. And these plays work at an organizational level, they work at a team level, and they work at an individual level. Many of the topics we talked about today are things that we go into depth on in the plays. And you walk out of this workshop with a playbook that is unique to your team based on their situations. I've now done this with hundreds of teams, and no two teams have ever had the same playbooks. So it's really an interesting workshop. And so we have one that's going to be at the school in Chattanooga, so you get to meet the students and see the school while we do the workshop in October. Or we can bring it to a company conference room near you. So happy to do that, too. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamic. With Balsamic mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. Learn more about Chicago Camps events on our website at chicagocamps.org.